started this evening. Let's begin with a word of prayer together. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you for this opportunity that we have to come together as your people and to study your word. We're thankful that you have preserved truths for us, that you have revealed yourself to us, that you've reached down to us and let us know that you are, that you've created us. You've created us for things better than we see around us, and that you love us and want to be in relationship with us. Help us to appreciate daily the things that you do and to give ourselves to you wholeheartedly. In your Son we pray. Amen. I want to start this evening by talking just a few minutes about what's been going on here the last couple days, and we'll be going through tomorrow as well. I know this isn't a work of this group in particular, but we're kind of in the middle of it since our building's being used for it. It was the brainchild of a friendly acquaintance. I'm not quite sure exactly what to call him. We know each other, but not that well. He was in South Carolina at the time. He's preaching in Indiana now, and basically it was an idea to get a group of preachers together, particularly primarily younger guys, and do some intensive study, some opportunity for them to practice giving some sermons and get feedback in kind of a safe environment. Better feedback than you'll, no offense, typically get from a congregation that's either going to grill you on some minute point that really doesn't matter or just praise you without helping offer good corrective criticism. So that's all part of what was designed. It is specifically about preaching through the Gospel of Mark, just to have something that we're all working on together. In the morning, we have two sessions where someone speaks specifically on something related to Mark, and it's more of an older, better studied sort of person doing a presentation, 45 minutes or so. And then a second presentation that has to do with preaching rather than Mark. And so you've got a Mark session and a preaching session. Then we'll take a break for lunch. And then when we come back, there are four short sermons, really more sermonettes, you might say. They may be long for some denominational groups, but they're about 20 minutes. Which, I mean, not to, you know, impugn anybody, but that's short by our standards and long for some. So they're about 20 minutes. They've been assigned a text. They've known their text for a while. And so they preach for 20 minutes, and then we kind of talk about it for about 20 minutes. And we go through four of those in the afternoon. And that's basically what we're doing. It's been a very good, I think, very profitable sort of thing. In addition to, there's basically three younger speakers and one more established speaker. I don't know how many of you know Andrew Roberts over at Livingston. He's one of the guys that's speaking. Very good, very polished kind of speaker. Shane Scott's with the group, and he spoke today as well. And I think that is both to kind of give them an example of a better, more established, well-polished sort of speaker, and also to kind of make them give them the chance to see that, hey, it's not just you young guys that are getting some critique and pointers and advice and different views of looking at things. So that's what we've been doing. Like I said, I think it's been very beneficial to everybody that's been a part of it. I'm glad to have been a part of it. I'm glad that this space, that we've been able to offer this space and that it's worked out well. Several people have expressed appreciation for it, and I thought I'd pass that along as well, that we've been willing to use this space for this purpose. So I just want to kind of let you know what was going on with that. That does bring me to my next thought, which is, since I've been here from about 9 to 4 every day, it's raised the question for me, how on earth am I going to get ready for tonight in the midst of all of that? I had other very pressing deadlines on Monday, and my options, my only option really, was to neglect my family in the evenings and go back to the office and spend a lot of time working on that, or, you know, shirk my responsibilities and getting ready for class. And then it dawned on me, I'm not shirking my responsibility, I'm shirking Tom's responsibility, because this is his class, not mine. Which made it a whole lot easier for me to decide, I'm just going to talk about what I talked about this morning, with the group rather than trying to get something for Deuteronomy together. So what we're going to be doing is talking about Mark as narrative, which is the presentation that I gave for the Preaching the Gospel of Mark preacher workshop that's been going on this week. Some of this you're very familiar with, and I'm going to kind of modify on the fly from what I did this morning, because we've talked about some of this stuff in some length already in various kinds of contexts. But as you talk about narrative and as you talk about story, those are the kinds of words that sometimes people get really funny about. I know we've talked about this before. We know how language works. We know what language does. And then sometimes we just ignore all of those rules because we want to make some point. And the example that Tom has given before is, you know, if you're driving down the road and someone goes, "Hey, that's my church," we are almost always inclined to want to say either, "The church is the people, not the building," or, "Your church, did you die for it?" Both of those are important points to make and to think about and to realize, but no one would ever try to make those kinds of corollary points if I said, "Hey, that's my bank." "Oh, are you the founder? Did you establish it? Are you the chairman of the board?" Well, no, nobody thinks that at all when somebody makes that kind of statement about that. So we know how language works, but we get kind of funny with it sometimes in certain kinds of contexts. And the same thing is true with ideas like narrative and story. You know, people will from time to time talk about a story that is in the Bible and be met with a lot of resistance of, "It's not a story, it's history. It actually happened." Well, there's two problems with that. First of all, the word story doesn't mean fiction. That's just not what story means. We've all told stories about things that have happened in our lives at different times, and we've called them stories about things that have happened. "Hey, let me tell you about a story, what happened, you know, 20 years ago when I was, you know, whatever." We tell stories about our lives all the time, and that doesn't negate the historicity of the event. So we just don't need to get that worked up about it. But then the second thing is, from a story, narrative, literary perspective, there is a lot of artistry in the Bible. It is not just history for the sake of history and recounting events in some sort of just rote mechanical sort of way. It is told with literary artistry. And that is not to say that it is less historical, again, but just that it is well written. And Mark is no exception to this. And there are two levels that we could talk about this. We could talk about the macro level, which is the big picture. Then we could talk about the micro level, which are smaller sorts of things. And so what I'll do is spend some time talking about each of these perspectives a little bit more on one or two subpoints here and there along the way. But that's where we're headed, is to talk about narrative features within the Gospel of Mark that I think help us understand it a little bit better. The first one is no surprise, because I know Tom's talked about this some here as well, and that is the big picture structure of the Gospel of Mark that you see in particular, beginning with this healing of the blind man, this really funny story in Mark chapter 8, where they come to Bethsaida, some people bring Jesus the blind man, and he takes him out of the city, and he spits in his eyes, which is just, there's a lot of weird stuff in this story. He spits in his eyes, and he says, "Can you see anything?" Which is kind of weird too, because Jesus doesn't ask questions after he heals people, he tells them things. He doesn't say, "Hey, can you walk now?" He says, "Take up your bed and walk." He doesn't say, "Hey, are you doing okay?" He says, "Go your way and sin no more. You know, carry on with your life. You're healed." So to ask the question is itself an oddity in this. And then there's the fact, the weirdest thing of all, which is, "Well, I kind of see, but people kind of look like they're trees. I can't really see clearly." And so Jesus lays his hands on him again and opens his eyes, and his sight was restored and he sees everything clearly. And it's this two-stage healing. And of course, Jesus doesn't take two tries because he didn't have his, you know, miracle Wheaties that morning, and he's a little bit low on the miracle meter. That's not what's going on. He's doing this for some kind of purpose. It's designed to teach us something. And again, I don't think there's any surprises here for this group. But notice, just as a way of reinforcing this, what happens on either side of this story. Right before this is the account of them in the boat, and he warns them to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they're like, "Oh man, we forgot the bread." And Jesus is like, "What are you talking about, you morons? Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." And they have to come to realize on their own that what he's talking about is their influence, their teaching, not their actual leaven. And so they don't understand. And that's, you know, where this goes as well. And this is a really remarkable thing, because Jesus will take a prophecy of Isaiah that he typically is using against the Jewish leaders and the multitudes, the people that he doesn't want to understand things so that they'll repent, as he talks about as he introduces parables. And he applies this to the apostles themselves. Notice in verse 17, right there in the middle, "Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened, having eyes you do not see, and having ears you do not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets?" And so forth and so on. And so this language of the prophecy of Isaiah is applied to the apostles themselves. And for what it's worth, that account sits square in the middle of a deaf man being healed and a blind man being healed. So the deaf can hear, the blind can see, and the apostles can't do either, as far as it goes. But they don't understand, is the point here. And that's verse 21 as that comes to a conclusion. Do you not yet understand? And then right after that is the confession of Peter, which of course is a, you might think, a high mark in the gospel. Hey, this is great. He understands something. He knows that Jesus is the Christ, and that is the confession there in verse 29. You know, unlike the people that think he's John the Baptist or Elijah or one of the prophets, he understands that Jesus is the Christ. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And so this story looks good at first, but it doesn't end with Peter saying, "You are the Christ," but with Jesus saying, "You are Satan." And so it doesn't really go so well there by the end of things. And of course, this is the first of two confessions of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. Notice that Peter's confession in Mark's Gospel is different than Peter's confession in Matthew's Gospel. And Matthew's Gospel is the one we're most familiar with, at least in terms of this verse. In general, Matthew tends to be more familiar to us because it's the first one. That I think that's part of it as much as anything, is we read that one first. Whether or not we ever get along enough in our daily Bible reading to get to Mark is its own question. But we know Matthew better. "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Well, in Mark, it's just, "You are the Christ." The "you are the Son of God" confession doesn't show up with Peter. It shows up on the lips of the centurion. And that's a striking thing, because when you get to Mark chapter 15, when does he confess Jesus is the Son of God? Well, he's a centurion, so it's there at the cross, right? But the text gives us specific detail. Does anyone remember that? When it is in the narrative that the centurion says, "Surely this man was the Son of God"?
It's after he dies.
It's after he dies. Yeah, the veil of the temple is torn. There's a bunch of stuff going on. And what the text says is when he sees the manner in which he died, he says, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Now, what is the one thing that Peter doesn't want to accept when he says, "You are the Christ"? That Jesus is going to go to Jerusalem and die. It's the one bit of information that Peter just cannot begin to swallow that is what leads the centurion to the second part of this confession. It's not just Peter, it's all the apostles. I mean, Peter is acting as a spokesman for the group in this case. And we'll talk more about their difficulty with Jesus teaching that he's going to die in just a moment. But it's the exact piece of information that they refused to believe when he confessed only the first half, or when they confessed only the first half. They knew that Jesus was the Christ, but they had no idea what that meant. And what it meant was that he had to go die as God's Son, and that's what leads to the second part of the confession as well. And then that brings us to the two goals of Mark's gospel. Mark begins by telling us what his gospel is about. It is the gospel of Jesus. And then he describes Jesus in two ways. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus, Christ, Messiah, the Anointed One, the Son of God. And so there are two things that Mark wants us to understand about Jesus. One is that he is Christ, and two is that he is Son of God. And that's striking when you've got two confessions in Mark's gospel, one that he is Christ and one that he is Son of God. And what it all really works its way out is it shows us that this miracle is something of the transition point from one section of Mark's gospel to the other. Jesus is first at pains to show his disciples that he is the Messiah. And they have come to understand that he is the Messiah. I mean, the number of miracles in the beginning of Mark up to this point is pretty astonishing. And they have come to understand that he is the Messiah, that he is the Christ. But they had no idea what that meant. And so the second half of the gospel then is designed to teach them what it means that he is the Messiah. And so three times in pretty quick succession, as the gospel makes its transition from Peter's confession to Jesus teaching about what this means, Jesus predicts that he is going to die. And then this miracle in Mark chapter 8 serves as another bookending sort of thing. It's not just a transition point, but it, what happens right after this miracle is Jesus, there are a variety of stories, but Jesus three times in pretty quick succession teaches that he's going to die. And I know, as Tom said before, every time Jesus says he's going to die, the disciples immediately do something stupid. But it doesn't end there. It ends with Jesus then teaching a little bit more and trying to correct their understanding. And so Peter confesses Jesus is the Christ. Jesus says, I'm going to go die. Peter rebukes him, and Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. But then notice in verse 34, calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would lose his, or save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. And so chapter 8 ends with this teaching of what it means, what they have to come to understand, what they have to come to accept is that being a disciple means taking up a cross and giving up your life. In fact, giving up everything that you have and everything that you are in order to follow Jesus. And so that's the teaching that follows. We'll flip over to Mark chapter 9. And when you get down to verse 30, they went on from there and passed through Galilee. And he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand the saying, and they were afraid to ask him. And when they came to Capernaum, when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you discussing on the way? But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. You want to talk about arguments that are... Have you ever been involved in an argument about who the greatest person in the room was? I mean, even if you were ever tempted to make that argument, you'd have enough sense to keep your mouth shut and not actually say it. These guys are actually arguing about who the greatest among them is. And he sat down and called the 12. And he said to them, if anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. And he took a child and put him in the midst of them. And taking him in his arms, he said to them, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. And so, again, the teaching follows their boneheadedness, I guess you might say. And then over to chapter 10, another page over in verse 32. And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed. Those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, see, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit in his face and flog him and kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him and said to him, teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. And he said to them, what do you want me to do for you? And they said to him, grant us to sit one at your right hand and one on your left hand in your glory. Jesus said to them, you do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? And they said, we are able. Jesus said to them, the cup that I drink, you will drink. And the baptism with which I'm baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand and my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those to whom it has been prepared. And when the ten heard it, they became indignant at James and John. And Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them, but it shall not be so among you. Whoever will be great among you must be your servant, and whoever will be first among you must be your slave, must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And so after this healing of the two-stage healing of the blind man that shows how blind the disciples are, Jesus then on three occasions tries to teach them what he is going to do. And they respond by doing something stupid. And he then comes back and tries to teach them again what, not just what he is doing, but what that means in the context of their lives and how they need to come to accept the fact that Jesus is going to die. And they need to follow in that same pattern of self-sacrificial selflessness and willingness to give up everything for the sake of God. And then notice what happens immediately after this. They came to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a great crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, "Jesus, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." And many rebuked him, telling him to be silent, but he cried out all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." And Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." And they called the blind man, saying to him, "Take heart, get up, he is calling you." And throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. And Jesus said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" And the blind man said to him, "Rabbi, let me recover my sight." And Jesus said to him, "Go your way, your faith has made you well." And immediately he recovered his sight and followed him on the way. You notice we have another blind man. Immediately after. So this whole teaching of Jesus trying to clarify what it means is followed by another healing of another blind man. And while the apostles still don't have everything figured out completely, I think the point in contrasting the one with the other is now there is enough information that they should be able to see clearly if they would just listen. And there's also a lot of connections between this. Both stories begin exactly the same way. And not everything in Mark's gospel starts this way. Verse 22 of Mark 8 is, "And they came to Bethsaida." Verse 46 of chapter 10 is, "And they came to Jericho." It's an identical opening to the story, just with a different city in place instead. The fact that this blind man, Bartimaeus, confesses Jesus, Son of David, which is a messianic title. Well, that brings us back to Peter confessing that Jesus was the Christ. The fact that Jesus has taught them they must give up everything. And this blind beggar, what do you think his possessions in life consisted of? Well, we know he had a cloak, and he threw it aside to follow Jesus. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot. Maybe something to sit on, you know, maybe a few things. But the entirety of his possessions, as you can tell from the Gospel of Mark, is this cloak that he tosses aside to follow Jesus. Here is a man who literally gives up everything to come after Jesus, which fits perfectly with the teaching. Notice Jesus asks this man, "What do you want me to do for you?" That's the exact question he asked James and John. Now, their answer is very different from this man's answer. In a lot of ways. But again, it's one of those connections that are bringing all of these different stories together and telling you there is a common thread running through all of this, tying all of these pieces together. The contrast between the first blind man who's healed in two stages and this one whose healing is much more like what you expect in the Gospel of Mark. And that's one of the really crazy things about that two-stage healing back in chapter 8 is the most... I was going to say the most common. It's not the most common word in Mark. But the most noteworthy word in Mark. Does anyone know what it is? The word that just shows up over and over and over and over again in Mark. What's that? Immediately. Mark uses the word immediately 37 times, I think it is, in his gospel. He uses it like 11 times in the first chapter alone. Everything is immediately. And it shows up a lot in the miracles as well. Immediately the man's strength was restored. And he took up his mat and walked. Immediately he was cleansed of his leprosy. And here, immediately he recovered his sight and followed him on his way. And so that contrast, I think, is built into this as well. And so this is kind of the other end of this next main section Because right after this is the triumphal entry, and we're into the final week of Jesus' life and the cross and the resurrection that follows. And so everything between the confession that Peter makes and Jesus teaching and trying to get them to understand is bracketed by these two blind men stories that tie that entire section together in a narrative structure. And so you should read all of these as being, you know, part and parcel of the same broader teaching of what Jesus is doing. So I don't have anything on the PowerPoint for that, but that's maybe something a little bit different from what you've heard in the past. Let me stop for a second, and I'm probably going to skip this, and maybe we'll come back to it if there's time. But any thoughts about the blind men and everything that we've talked about so far? Right, and it's not, and this isn't what you were saying, but just to kind of clarify further, because you did add a little bit to this, it's not just literary artistry for the sake of literary artistry. It's not just, oh, that's really cool, it's bookended by these stories. It changes how you read some of these things, to see these connections, to realize, oh, these two blind men stories aren't just two random blind men, they're bookending a major section of the gospel where Jesus is trying to get them from not seeing clearly to being able to see clearly. And everything in between is a part of that purpose of what Jesus is doing. And so it's a narratively beautiful thing that's going on, but it also is a very instructive and helpful thing as far as it goes. And Adam's absolutely right. You don't see this just by reading a chapter a day. For that matter, you don't see it by reading the entirety of the Gospel of Mark once and then going on to Luke. This is the kind of thing that takes a lot of time in the text to be able to pick up on these sorts of things. And it can be helped by study aids of kinds as well. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I came up with all that on my own by reading the Gospel of Mark 50 times. The reality is I've picked up bits and pieces here and there along the way, and you take that and you test it against what the text says, and hopefully you can tell if there's merit to it or not, and you take the things that are good and you toss them aside. One of the things I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about tomorrow, actually, is the right and wrong use of commentaries. And that's, I think, a helpful sort of thing to think about as well. But it's that same sort of idea. You take various things that you've picked up along the way, and you bring it into what you're thinking, and you work through it all and go from there. Greg? It's pretty common in the Bible. That kind of thing is pretty common in the Bible. I've not personally done enough with writings from antiquity to know if it's common outside the Bible. My guess is that it is, but I don't know offhand. That's a really good question, though. Any other thoughts here? All right, well, there was one other macro level thing, but it's a little bit more technical, a little bit, I think, less practically helpful. And so I wanted to spend some time on some other things in Mark's gospel that I think are more helpful for the text itself. And it's the smaller level kinds of narrative sorts of things. And what I've got here in the first category is something of a catch-all. And this is what I spent less time with this morning when I was talking about this. I'm going to spend more time with it now. Because the second piece of the micro level is the Markan sandwich, which we've talked about before, where Mark takes a narrative and splits it in half and sticks a different story in between. The cursing of the fig tree, we just did that sermon a couple weeks ago. It has the cleansing of the temple in the middle. That's the Markan sandwich. So if we've got time, we may talk about an example of that as well. But I want to spend more of our time on some of these littler kinds of things. The fact that Mark is filled with vivid, descriptive details that sometimes the other Gospels lack. They're not as concerned with these kinds of things. And what makes this a remarkable thing is, I'm sorry, I did that this morning too by accident, a remarkable thing. I'm going to really try to not say that repeatedly, but it's really the right word. So it's better when we're not studying Mark. What makes this such a unique, someone give me a synonym, important, noteworthy, there we go, thing is that Mark is so short. Mark is the shortest of the Gospels, pretty significantly shorter than the others. So you would think that if there's going to be one Gospel that has a lot of little details in it, it wouldn't be this one. It'd be the longest of them. And yet Mark is the one that has all kinds of details that the others omit along the way. Let me give you a few examples of this running through these verses here on the screen. Chapter 2 and verse 4 is the story of the paralytic. And this one isn't it's kind of precise, but it's a little bit less obvious in the English. The verb that Mark uses to talk about them coming through the roof to lower the man down is a verb that is a word for digging. So in Matthew, I believe, they just kind of take the roof apart and lower him down. In Mark, they're digging through the roof, which is a different sort of image that you, instead of just kind of taking apart, they're up there working at it in order to get through in Mark's account. In chapter 3 and verse 9, he sends the disciples off to get the boat ready for him, which he doesn't do in the other Gospels. Mark chapter 3 and verse 34 is an interesting one as well. Mark 3:34, this is another one of those Mark and sandwiches. This is where Jesus' family go out to get him because they think he's lost his mind. And then in the middle of the story is the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit text is there. And then the end of that story is his mother and his brothers arrive to take him away. And it's kind of a nice dramatic sort of moment in that particular sandwich because you find out that it's not just any family members that have thought he's crazy. It's his mother and his brothers. It's people really on the inside. People with the best information are the ones who've come to get him. And you remember what Jesus' response to that is, right? They say, hey, your mother and your brothers are outside. And Jesus says, who is my mother and my brothers? It's those who are, you know, following after God, to paraphrase, is the idea. But what's unique about Mark's account is in Mark chapter 3 and verse 34, we're told that Jesus, when they say this to Jesus, Jesus kind of stops what he's doing and looks around the room to see all of the people who are sitting around him. And it's a little detail that you can read right past. It's not incredibly significant, but it adds something to Jesus in this. It's not an offhanded response that Jesus makes. He's not just, you know, flying off the handle with something. He is being very deliberate in what he's saying. He's stopping and he's looking around, and you can almost imagine him making eye contact with various people as he looks by before he gives this powerful statement about who his mother and his brothers are. And it kind of changes, at least a little bit, how you read that statement to know that Jesus is, you know, looking around the room as he makes the statement. In Mark chapter 4 is the storm on the sea when Jesus is asleep. And the disciples are really worried about what's going on. Mark is the only one that gives the account that Jesus is A, in the stern of the boat asleep, and B, sleeping on a cushion. And so those aren't, you know, pressing sorts of details. But again, it's noteworthy that Mark is making that point. He's giving those kinds of details. And Mark chapter 5, the casting out of Legion, the Gerasene demoniac, there's too many to try to list without spending a lot of time on it. But there's a host of details about his living condition before Jesus cast the demons out that aren't included in the other Gospels. And one that I think we've talked about before, in Mark chapter 6, the feeding of the 5,000, he has the people sit down on the green grass, which is an interesting little detail to give. The green grass. It's a detail that fits, it squares very well with the historical reality of the situation. You find out from John's account that this is at the Passover that this miracle happens. The Passover is right at the end of the rainy season. It is as lush and beautiful as it gets. You can Google pictures of, Galilee, the region of Galilee, during the rainy season, and it is just, it's beautiful. It's not what you typically think of when you just imagine what Israel looks like. So there would be just a lot, plenty of green grass for people to sit down on. So it squares well with that. More significantly, it calls to mind other green grass passages that you find. And in particular, the one that calls to mind, I think, in the broader context of what Mark is doing is Psalm 23. The green pastures. And part of the reason why it calls that to mind is, one, when Jesus gets off the boat and he sees the multitude, he sees them as sheep without a shepherd. And then he prepares a table for them, so to speak. And he has them sit down in the green grass and so forth and so on. And so this is a subtle, I am the shepherd kind of moment. It's not like the teaching in John, of course, where Jesus, says, I am the good shepherd. But it's the same sort of idea that is showing up. Secondly, and this is similar along those lines, but a different sort of perspective in terms of Mark adding things that other Gospels don't include. And for what it's worth, that was just a few examples. You could find loads of other examples of Mark's vivid details if you just look for them. And they don't even all have to be things that other Gospels don't include. Even if the other Gospels do include them, there's still vivid details in Mark. Mark is just loaded with these things. And it makes Mark... it makes Mark interesting to read. It makes Mark itself more vivid. You get sometimes a clearer picture of what's going on in Jesus himself in Mark than you get in some of the other Gospels. Another piece of this is what I've called psychological comments as well, where Mark gives us insight into what people are thinking that very often the others don't give. So in Mark chapter 1 is the healing of the leper, and Jesus sees the man and he is moved with pity by him. In Mark chapter 9, this one's not as explicit, but I think it's told in such a way that you have implicit psychological commentary. We read this a few moments ago. This is, they come to Capernaum after Jesus has gotten done teaching that he's going to go die. And he goes, hey guys, what were you talking about on the road? And there is this very heavy silence as they don't want to talk about it. It's a lot like the silence that you get when you walk into your children's room and you say, what's going on in here? And they're doing something that they shouldn't be doing. It's a silence that is laden with guilt, is what it is. And so Mark doesn't come out and say, and they were silent because they were filled with guilt, but you feel it when you read the text. And so that's a little bit less of a clear example. Mark chapter 10 and verse 21, the rich young ruler. Very common passage, very familiar passage. Here's a guy that's got a lot right in terms of him coming to God or to Jesus. And, he's a devout Jew. He acknowledges that Jesus is a great teacher. He runs up to him and he bows before him and he asks the right question, what must I do to be saved? Or some paraphrase of that idea. But he's clueless. And he refuses to acknowledge what Jesus wants him to acknowledge. When Jesus says, no one is good but God alone, here's what you must do, keep all the commandments. Now, what kind of person will say, I'm good, I got it, in that context? And which is essentially what this guy does. He doesn't come out and say, well, I'm good too, like God is. He doesn't come out and say, I have obeyed every single commandment that there is, but that's the essence of it. What Jesus' response should make this man do is realize his guilt. But he doesn't realize his guilt. He goes, oh, I've done all of these things since I was a kid. It'd be like, Jesus saying to us, this is what you must do. Go to a church with the right sign where they do the right things inside and they take the Lord's Supper every first day of the week. Oh, I've done that since my youth. Well, you know what? There's more to being a faithful follower of God than that. And in reality, this man hasn't even done all of that. Part of what Jesus tells him to do is love your neighbor. And so when Jesus says, you lack one thing, go sell all you have and give to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven, come follow me, he's putting him to the test. Have you actually done the things that you say you have done? But notice what happens before that. in verse 21, where Jesus, looking at him, loved him and said to him this. It's not a harsh thing Jesus is saying to drive him away. It's a thing that Jesus is saying in love. And I think it's the same kind of love that God has for the people of Israel and the prophets, where he loves them dearly even as he is sending them away and punishing them. It's the kind of love that is manifest sometimes in a heart being broken. And that's the way that I typically look at this passage. Here is this man who has so much right, and yet Jesus knows his heart, and he knows that this man is about to break God's heart one more time. And it is in love that he gives him this ultimate test, and he fails it. Of course, there's loads of psychological detail in Gethsemane as well. The amazement and fear of the disciples, the crowds in chapter 10 and verse 32. There's just a lot of these kinds of things going on. And then the last one of these little things is Mark's use of the word immediately, which we've already talked about a little bit. This is something that it does various things in various places, but it is constantly driving forward the narrative and keeping the reader aware of the dramatic development of the story. It points us in the compressed time that Jesus has to do a lot of things and how he's constantly at work trying to fulfill his mission. So there's a variety of things that this does, and we don't need to try to expound on all of that here. So thoughts about these three kind of ideas? Anything? All right, well, let's spend our last few minutes then coming back to this Mark and sandwich idea. Like I said in the sermon, the very precise technical highbrow term that scholars have come up with, the Mark and sandwich. And I promise I'm not making that up. I mean, you go read any commentary on Mark and you're going to find Mark and sandwich in there. I checked one of the most technical commentaries that I've got. And it says Mark and sandwich. So it goes all the way to the top of scholarship. So, but the one we've talked about before is the cursing of the fig tree and the cleansing of the temple. And that's a good example because it shows how sometimes the two different narratives explain each other. And how if you understand what's going on with the fig tree, it clarifies what's going on with the cleansing of the temple. And if you understand what's going on with the cleansing of the temple, it helps you understand what's going on with the miracle of the fig tree. And there's this kind of symbiotic union is what came to my mind, between the two stories that work together that way. But not all of them are doing that exact thing. So let's look at Mark chapter 14. Where there's another one of these, and we'll just read it to start, and then we'll see what kind of time we have left to make any comments about it as well. So Mark chapter 14 and verse 53, and they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together. And Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the guards, warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none, for many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands.' Yet even about this their testimony did not agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, 'Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?' But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?' And Jesus said, 'I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven.' And the high priest tore his garments and said, 'What further witness do we need? You've heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?' And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some of them began to spit on him and cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, 'Prophesy.' And the guards received him with blows. And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, 'You also were with the Nazarene Jesus.' But he denied it, saying, 'I neither know nor understand what you mean.' And he went out into the gateway, and the rooster crowed, and the servant girl saw him and began to say again to the bystanders, 'This man is one of them.' But again he denied it. And after a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, 'Certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean. But he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, I do not know this man of whom you speak. And immediately the rooster crowed the second time. And Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. And he broke down and wept. And so the sandwich here is Peter on the outside, Peter who follows him in, Peter who is warming himself at the fire. And then the action leaves Peter and it goes to Jesus. And you find Jesus on trial and Jesus being questioned and Jesus confessing, I am indeed the Christ. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power. And that is all the evidence they need to send him away to be crucified. And then the action shifts back to Peter. And so there's a bit of a dramatic sort of thing going on here where you wonder what's going to happen with Peter. Well, we're setting that aside for a moment. Let's tell the story of Jesus. But then you come back to Peter and the story of Peter denying Jesus. So how are these two stories working together? Any thoughts? Yeah, this is a story of contrast is what this is. And so as you look at these, you know, Mark and Sandwich stories, just because you see one and you understand what's going on with it, oh, this is clarifying the one on the outside, the one on the outside is clarifying the one on the inside. That's not necessarily what they're all doing. And so here is one where you've got a story of contrast. You've got a little bit of the dramatic element of postponing the action, but more than that is you've got the contrast of Jesus and his reaction to the trial and Peter and his reaction to the trial. And of course, this is following on the heels of Gethsemane, where Jesus has said, watch and pray that you may not fall into temptation. And Jesus succeeds in prayer and the apostles fail in prayer. And then Jesus succeeds in the trial and Peter fails in the trial. And so it's connected back to that as well. Greg? Yeah. Yeah. That's a good connection to make as well. All right. Any thoughts on any of this? We're out of time. So, like I said, I did this in large part because it simplified my life a whole lot to not have to get Deuteronomy ready for tonight. So I hope this has been helpful to you and not just a cop-out for me. Sunday we'll be back to Deuteronomy. And I imagine